I'm Laura Murphy Oates, and this is The Full Story. With just over 15% of Australia's population fully vaccinated against COVID-19, there are concerns that not enough Australians are coming forward to get vaccinated. But with conflicting advice on vaccination from state and federal governments, a lot of people are struggling to combat the rise of vaccine hesitancy in their communities and their families. Today, we hear from The Guardian's medical editor, a health communications expert, and a Guardian reader on how to talk to your family and friends about vaccination. It's Wednesday, the 4th of August. So Mel, I feel like the first question I should ask is, are you vaccinated?
Yes, I am. So I'm 35 years old, and a couple of months ago now, I rang my GP and said, look, can I get the AstraZeneca vaccine? I'd be really, really happy to get it.
Melissa Davey is Guardian Australia's medical editor.
And the receptionist at the time said to me, well, we actually can't get rid of it. We've got so much of it. I'm sure it's fine. I'll book you in with your GP to have a chat about it. So I had a chat to my GP, and I actually didn't realise that I qualified for vaccination anyway under 1B. I've got a bunch of different health conditions, which I just didn't, they don't really bother me. I feel like I'm very fit, I'm very healthy, but my GP said that I should actually get Pfizer. So she wrote me a letter, and I did say to her, I don't mind getting AstraZeneca. Like, I know there's a shortage of Pfizer at the moment. I'm really happy to just get AZ. And she said to me, well, it's not your fault. The government didn't order enough Pfizer, and you're absolutely eligible. And I'm writing you a letter for Pfizer. So that's what you're going to get. So I've now been fully vaccinated. What about you?
I'm booked in to get Pfizer in a couple of weeks. I was also happy to get AstraZeneca, but was a bit hesitant about getting a GP referral in a pandemic, in an outbreak in Sydney. So kind of struggled with trying to get an AstraZeneca booking for a little while, and then Pfizer just suddenly popped up and became available, and I'm getting my first shot in 2 weeks now, which is very exciting.
That's great.
There is a lot of ongoing confusion and concern around the vaccines, especially around AstraZeneca or AZ. I'm wondering, if someone is concerned about AZ or knows someone who is concerned, what are the key things that you think they need to know, Mel?
I guess the most important point to make about that is that AstraZeneca and Pfizer, once you've had both doses, are about 95% effective at preventing severe disease and death. So this is preventing the kind of disease that would see you admitted to hospital or put on a ventilator or worst case scenario dying. That's what you want from your vaccines. They're both very, very effective at that. Now, a study published just last month in July by the New England Journal of Medicine and led by Public Health England found that two doses of Pfizer is about 88% effective at preventing symptomatic disease from the Delta variant. And that's pretty good compared to other variants as well. So the Alpha variant, it was 93.7% effective, for example. Two shots of the AstraZeneca vaccine are 67% effective against the Delta variant. So remember, this is how effective they are at preventing any symptoms at all. They're both really, really strong, more than 90% effective at stopping really severe disease and death, but they're both also pretty good at stopping any symptoms at all.
One of the things that a lot of people have been concerned about with AstraZeneca is the risk of fatal blood clots. Have we learned any more about the risk of blood clots and what to do if we do get that side effect?
Yeah, definitely. So we know that the most worrying symptoms associated with this severe clotting, known as TTS, is most likely to occur within the first 4 days, and people are given very specific symptoms to watch out for. And physicians and specialists are getting much better at treating and identifying it as well. So the death rate is going down. So even if you do develop this very, very rare condition known as TTS, the chances of dying are about 20%. That's obviously high, but your chances of getting the condition in the first place are very rare. But I was also looking at data from the UK, and this data is useful because the UK has really widely used AstraZeneca. Millions of people have had the vaccine. And according to the UK Parliament, between the 9th of December last year and the 5th of May this year, there's been more than 260 cases of TTS, and that's equivalent to about 11 cases per million doses. Now, the vast majority of these TTS cases were reported following the first dose and only 8 after the second dose. So chances are, if you get through the first dose fine, your second dose will be absolutely okay as well.
So out of the very small amount of people who do get this blood clot, it is only fatal in 1 in 5 people.
Yeah, that's based on the data from the UK where millions of people have had the vaccine.
Another concern that I feel like has lingered and that I keep hearing is, how can I trust this vaccine when it has been developed so quickly? What do you say to that concern?
There was a global focus on this vaccine where the best scientists in the world dropped what they were doing and focused all of their efforts all at once on developing a vaccine against COVID-19. And that sped up the process a lot, but it didn't mean corners were cut or that the science was rushed. And because governments were also extremely keen to get a treatment for this horrible virus that was spreading around the world, they also prioritised funding. So funding for this kind of research and to develop a vaccine can be very difficult to secure. It can take months. This was all fast-tracked. So basically, it wasn't the science that was rushed, but a lot of the bureaucracy behind getting approvals for trials and getting funding for trials, that was all looked at very, very quickly. In fact, if there was any treatment you were going to take and have faith in, the fact that scientists from around the globe are all interrogating this vaccine, working on this vaccine, scrutinising the data from vaccine trials and then its rollout in the community, that gives me great reassurance that there is no way that anything associated with this vaccine that's concerning could get past the regulators or get past the scientists or the public. I think that in a way, though, that's been a double-edged sword, because with any other treatment, you don't have this kind of intense global focus. And so with these vaccines, every tiny little symptom, side effect, rare event is really analysed and publicised and scrutinised. Mm. And that can almost give too much weight to those side effects that can make the vaccine seem scarier than they are.
Right. A common thing that I've heard and seen people post is, you don't look at what's in some, you know, maybe illicit drugs that you take or prescription drugs that you take. You know, why are you so concerned about the side effects of this vaccine when usually maybe people don't look at those side effects in common things that they take every day?
Or even other vaccines. So the flu vaccine is a really good example. We don't know the brand of the vaccine we get with the flu vaccine. We just trust that it's the right thing to do, especially to protect vulnerable people who, you know, old people die every year from the flu.
A really live conversation right now is the safety of the vaccine for kids, with the advice on that changing quite recently. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so the government announced this week that any child between the ages of 12 and 15 who are immunocompromised, so they might have other health conditions that make them vulnerable to COVID, if they're Indigenous or they live in a remote community, they can get the Pfizer vaccine. And that's similar to the advice in the UK, where, again, millions of people now have had the vaccine, including children. And the US also recommends that anyone over the age of 12 get vaccinated and has announced it will look into vaccinating children as young as 4 from December.
So this is a lot of the key facts that people need to know when having these conversations around vaccination or when thinking about getting vaccinated themselves. But what about how to have these conversations, Mel? It's a really tricky area when you're approaching your closest friends and family.
It's such a difficult one. And, you know, I would just say that there is a lot of advice and information online, whether you're looking at Federal Department of Health websites or State Department of Health websites. If you don't trust those, there are lots of really good peak bodies that have information, like the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners or the Australian Medical Association. There are scientists and researchers that publish information as well, including scientific research institutes. So even if you don't trust the government, there's so many sources where you can have a look for this information. But I think when it comes to talking to people you care about, it depends on your relationship with that person and how they think.
Next, we hear from people about what it's like having the tough conversations around vaccination.
Hi, Laura. I'm recording a little narrative for you about what just happened. You can probably hear the noise of my toddler playing with his game right next to me because we're both up from, he's up from his nap. And I actually fell asleep as well because I'm 7 months pregnant and get really tired. But anyway, I just wanted to tell you a little bit.
This
about-
is a woman who we'll be calling Sam.
I'm a 38-year-old woman and I'm grew up all over the world. My family's all in the US and my husband's Australian and I now live here in Sydney.
The reason we're not using her name is that she recently had a tough conversation with a close friend.
I was chatting with a good friend of mine here who is just a few weeks ahead of me in her pregnancy, telling her excitedly that I had managed to get a Pfizer appointment. And I was quite surprised that she said that she was just very, that she respected my decision to get vaccinated, but that she herself would not be getting vaccinated as a pregnant woman because she didn't think there was enough research on the long-term impacts of vaccines. So I kind of took the information in and sat with it for about a day, and then I thought, usually I'd be very non-confrontational, I would just think, you know, live and let live, but in this case I thought I would sort of build up my courage and actually try to have a conversation with her and just share my point of view on why I thought it was important to get vaccinated and why I didn't think it was posing a danger to our unborn children.
Faced with a friend's opposition to the vaccine, Sam looked at the government advice, and that states that while research on the safety of AstraZeneca for pregnant women isn't there yet, the Pfizer vaccine is definitely safe for pregnant women. And it's recommended at any stage of pregnancy, whether you're pregnant, breastfeeding, or just planning a pregnancy. Also, the risks of not getting vaccinated are high. Pregnant women have a higher risk of severe illness from COVID-19, and their babies also have a higher risk of being born prematurely. After reading that advice and talking to friends of hers who were doctors, Sam decided to text a friend.
Look, I've been talking to some really good friends of mine who are doctors who are watching this play out in the US in hospitals with unvaccinated women. And I think that it's much better to be on the safe side and get vaccinated, not only for the health of your unborn baby, but for your health. And so I would just encourage you to reconsider getting the vaccine. And I was really pleased because she wrote back and said that my message had encouraged her to reconsider, and she's been doing some more research. She is now actually going to look for an appointment to get a vaccine. So it was a really good outcome.
All right. So I'm Michael Cammett. So my official thing, if you look at the PhD wanky thing, is Dr. Michael Cammett, PhD.
Dr. Michael Cammett is a social media researcher living and working in Western Sydney.
So particularly in the medical profession, they really think they have this thing about calling you a doctor when you're not a medical doctor. So it's Dr. Michael Cammett, PhD. And I'm an independent researcher.
Can you actually just tell me a little bit about yourself outside of work?
How much? I'm a barbershop. I sing in a barbershop quartet.
Really?
So I, like most people from the Philippines, I love singing. So I, a whole new world, you know, like this whole.
Outside of his singing career, Michael also has more than 20 years of experience in multicultural health communication, which essentially means he worked on a lot of health campaigns.
Like, ring a quit line, ring a phone number if you're a smoker, or buy and install a smoke alarm. So that was my very first campaign in 97, Arabic, Chinese and Vietnamese, to increase smoke detector sort of installation.
But at the start of the pandemic, he was working on this research project.
So my research for the last 6 years was to explore the potential of social media for a two-way conversation, but also to enable agency for different groups. So what I did was essentially invited community leaders from migrant refugee backgrounds once a month for 3 hours, where we talk about social media. So we look at the basics, where we discuss but also provide skills. Those people then became, the community leaders then started coming back to me and say, Michael, we're actually starting to write our own messages on COVID-19 because, you know, we need something more. These are urgent messages. We're curating information from the government. We're doing all of this even before the translated, you know, the official translations came about. And I said, whoa, whoa. And I thought, this is quite profound, because that to me is about agency and this is about initiative. So they started doing that. Obviously, I didn't record all of those, but they started saying, where can we get more information on this, Michael? Where you know, we need masks. We need at this very early stage, but also things like we need food. You know, a couple of the women were working with asylum seekers from a Tamil background. And that's when they started talking about misinformation. Michael, you need to help us, you know, address misinformation. And I just went, eek. So that's when it was the time when I started thinking, oh, well, okay, when I was finishing my PhD, I thought, well, maybe it's time to put a proposal together to address misinformation. And that led me to this, my current research, which is called the Multicultural COVID-19 Resilience Project.
For the past year, Michael has been thinking a lot about how to combat misinformation around COVID-19 and the vaccine, both at work and in his personal life, which has meant having some hard conversations with family and friends.
So, for example, I have a friend and she's saying, oh, the swab, they use this particular chemical and it's really cancerous and it's blah, blah, blah.
This friend came to Michael with some fears around COVID tests and how safe they were for kids.
And basically, I said, tell me more. And of course, I didn't want to address the fact. So I said, so what's her story? There's some theory as well that a lot of communication is about this major stories about yourself. Mm. And one of it is, I'm a good parent and I want to protect my children. And I want... So finding that common, the biggest story for us is to say, look, everyone wants to protect their child. The reason I want to talk to you about this is because I acknowledge that you obviously are very passionate about that. And I also acknowledge that you want to find out the truth for your child and your family. Mm. So how about we start with that first?
Finding common ground about their concern.
Yeah, it's like an argument. Let's go back to the principles of having an argument. You need to, you know, listen. Listen, listen. And I think that's kind of the big theme about COVID-19 is there's not enough listening happening in the world at the moment. You know, so for me, that's what I did. So I spent a lot of time listening, but also building that relationship that I have with her. Mm. and affirming that we had that sort of relationship, you know. And then I started saying, okay, can you tell me who was the source of your message? Where's the website? Can we look at other places that this is found? And of course, she couldn't come up with all of those things. And I said, look, I just want you to think about that. And we left it at that. I think that's a sort of conversation. So one, don't unfriend them, don't antagonize them. Listen. Listen more than you talk, but find the story, find the narrative. What is it that they're worried about? For some of my friends who come from countries where the military was, you know, they just said, I just don't trust the government. So therefore, it's about trust. And I probably use a bigger word, and this is just my personal sort of theory that will probably need a bit more research. It's trauma. I'm not talking about just violent sort of backgrounds, but it's more of what happened, you know, either this personality or things in their childhood or something that has triggered them not to trust people, but to acknowledge as well that there's an erosion of trust in what they read and also with governments.
I mean, what you're talking about, this distrust of institutions, you see it a lot in Indigenous communities and, you know, it sounds like you're seeing it a lot in many other communities as well. How do you combat that, though? That's a deeply ingrained historical thing? I mean, do you have to combat that distrust of the institution in order to change someone's mind about, you know, the misinformation that they're getting?
I think going back to that thing is, if the narrative is about distrust, then the bigger narrative for me is hope. The hope for me is that our children, the legacy of our children, the legacy that we have is that we will be on the right side of history here. You know, it sounds kind of very profound, but at the same time, I want to see your child and I want to see my mother. Like, you know, when I graduate, my mom is, she'll kill me. My mother, classic example, we had this big thing about her mistrust for the vaccines and she was watching different types of media and she's got a doctorate, you know, but you think I had the biggest meltdown.
What was she watching?
CNN, BBC, but also her Facebook feed. I remember one of the things that we had an argument was about, she passed this thing that says, a friend of mine whose daughter is a nurse in New York, in one of the New York hospitals, no name, nothing, has seen this happen, blah, blah, blah.
Just out of interest, what was the actual conspiracy or story that your mum had come across that she was sharing with you?
That she said that a particular brand, the Chinese brand, was better than the Western brand.
Of vaccine?
The vaccination, yeah.
In the Philippines, where Michael's mum lives, COVID-19 infections are increasing and hundreds of deaths are occurring each week. So he was worried. But even though he's a health communications expert with years of experience, he still found it hard talking to his mum about the vaccine.
And of course, I wasn't mindful of, you know, all the things that I just told you earlier about listening to her. And then I kind of lost it. I said, do you know what I do? I said, Mum, I researched this thing. And of course, that was the worst thing because it made her feel like stupid. And often I think a lot of us who are in the field of, who have had education, who have been lucky enough, fortunate enough to have education, inadvertently patronize people like that.
Did your mum end up getting vaccinated?
Yes, I'm very happy to say that it's about informed choice, you know, for me. It was like she went with my sister-in-law and it was a free vaccination. I don't know how it happened, but I just got this message from her saying, I'm now with Janssen. I said, who's Janssen? Who's Janssen? What are you talking about, mum? Janssen. And she's saying,
who is this man that my mother is spending time with?
Who picked you up? You shouldn't go out with that Janssen. So you make fun of me, huh?
Did you? But you eventually realised she was talking about the vaccination.
My sister-in-law just explained, my sister said it's Johnson's. And it's a one-off vaccination. And,
you know. So, but it had to be her choice.
Yeah, but I think it's not as clear-cut as what people think misinformation is. It's about listening than telling people you're wrong.
That's it for today. This episode was produced by Ellen Lee Vita, Karishma Luthria, and Joe Coney, who also did the sound design. The executive producers of Full Story are Miles Martignoni, Gabrielle Jackson, and me, Laura Murphy-Oates. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave a rating or a review. Okay, catch you tomorrow.